Welcome, fellow members of the cosmos, to another exciting episode of Wild Connection, where we are always exploring our relationship to each other, other species, and who knows, maybe life on other planets. As always, I'm Dr. Jen, your captain on this journey. Today, we're venturing into the fascinating world of science communication with a sneak peek into how evolutionary genetics can go mainstream. Any Trekkie fans out there? This one's for you. And who better to join us on this intergalactic adventure than a true visionary, crossing the boundaries of science and science fiction? Beaming in from the far reaches of the cosmos is my fellow colleague and guest, Dr. Mohammed Noor. He's an evolutionary geneticist and a Darwin Wallace Medal recipient. Not only does he unravel the mysteries of life here on Earth, but he also consults for none other than Star Trek, where science meets the final frontier. As if that wasn't cool enough, he's also the author of a few books, including Live Long and Evolve, What Star Trek Can Teach Us About Evolution, Genetics, and Life on Other Worlds. It's an entertaining introduction to genetics and evolutionary concepts, all through the lens of a popular science television show. Before we embark on a voyage of discovery, as we boldly go where no podcast has gone before, a humble request. If you're enjoying the podcast, please give it a review and share it with your friends. All right, listeners, grab your tricorders, engage your warp drives, and set phasers for fun, because this is Wild Connection. Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals and exploring the complexity of their lives, their intelligence, relationships, families, social connections, and emotions. I also love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Wild Connection. I am very excited to bring to you my guest, Mohammed Noor. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on your podcast. It's an honor.
Oh, gosh, the honor is mine. And, you know, our paths have crisscrossed, even though I don't think we've ever directly collided in meeting each other. And so we're going to have to do that one of these days.
We'll make it happen.
Yes, but I was really thrilled that you agreed to be on the show because, you know, we work in a space that we can call science communication, right? How we talk to other people who aren't scientists about science. And you've been doing this for a very long time. And before we sort of dive into that, though, I'd love for people to get a sense of who my guests are. And so can you tell me a little bit about who you are, where you are, and what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. So as you said, my name is Mohammed Noor. I'm a biology professor at Duke University. I've been at Duke since 2005. Prior to that, I had a position at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge, which is also really fun. Day to day. Wow, that's a tough question. So I've been holding a lot of administrative roles lately. So, I mean, my current administrative role is interim vice provost for academic affairs, which my kids always like to tease me. Is like, that's the most generic name for anything. Or I'm like, well, it doesn't say at all what you actually do.
This is very true. It's like vanilla ice cream and on its own.
It sounds like that. Yeah. It's an interesting job. I only just started this in February 2023, so I haven't had this job for very long. I guess you'd say I'm the person who tries to operationalize initiatives from the provost. The provost is a top academic officer at any university. That's the provost. So I try to operationalize initiatives. Some of the things that I'm working on right now, for example, I'll just give a couple of examples. We have a big research building renewal process. We have these, you know, really old research buildings that are around from like the 1940s and 1960s. They need some major renovations, which I'm not figuring out the renovation piece, but I'm trying to figure out what are we going to do with the researchers who are in there? What are we going to do in terms of like, we're going to lose, and when we take these offline for renewals, we're going to lose classrooms for, you know, 2 years. Like, how are we going to fit that someplace else? So those sort of operationalizing processes are a big part of what I'm working right that right now. Besides that, I still have a research lab, and I have graduate students and technicians and folks like that, and there are various undergraduates as well. Yeah, and we're interested in studying right now the genetic basis and the evolutionary processes maintaining lethal causing alleles in Drosophila. So it's kind of weird that actually you'd think that why are lethal alleles even around, but they're really, really abundant in any species you study. So we're investigating that using fruit flies. I teach classes too. I mean, I've mostly been doing graduate seminars while I've been doing administrative work, because it's a pretty hefty extra job, but I still enjoy doing, you know, the occasional undergrad class in there, and actually I have one that's related to science communication we can come back to a little bit later on too. But hopefully that gives you a little bit of a sample of some of the things in my portfolio.
Your portfolio is pretty broad, and by training, so you brought up lethal alleles. I'm going to want to circle back to lethal alleles later, but you bring up sort of your lab and its focus. And so what is your training in? Are you're an evolutionary biologist?
That's correct.
Not every evolutionary biologist, you know, zeroes in on genetics. No. So what drew you to this field and to the specific types of questions that you've been investigating over your career?
Great question. That ties very well with science communication. But for me, when I was in college, I liked biology, but honestly, the introductory classes did not really grab my attention that much. I mean, they were very, you know, 1990s and late 1980s, early 1990s, they were very memorization heavy, memorize this, memorize that. Meh. It was okay. I kind of liked the topics, but the memorization aspect was not that interesting. I actually put off taking genetics until junior year because people told me it was really hard. But when I finally took it, I really enjoyed it. It's like, wow, this is really cool. It's a lot more of the how than just the what's you're memorizing. So that was neat. Then actually the second semester of junior year, I took an evolutionary genetics class. That was world-changing for me. I just absolutely loved it because it was very heavily on the why and how of basically anything you could see. I was 100% sold. And I was like, this is a field I want to go into for the rest of my career. You know? I used to sit in the front row and I'd just be like completely enraptured. I used to tape record the class and I would listen to it again later, not because I didn't catch it, but just because I enjoyed hearing it so much. So part of it has to do with the professor too, because the professor obviously was very eloquent about this. I mean, not everybody loved his style, but I thought he was fantastic. I mean, I just really loved the narrative style he did. It was very much like a story. It wasn't just a like memorize this, memorize that. It was like, this is what they used to think. And this was the basis for why they thought it. But then here's a set of experiments that happened. And this completely changed their understanding of it. It really was about the process of science. And that was fantastic. And I love the intersection of like, there was some mathematics to it, but very simple mathematics, like just algebra level. So I could really get it, you know, connecting to these evolutionary processes and genetics and everything. It just felt very integrative in a wonderful way.
Wow. You were the student we all dream of, right? The one hanging on our every word.
Well, I had the dream professor, so that made it easy.
Well, and you know, it's interesting that you say that you kind of avoided it until your junior year because people told you that it was hard. And I can say that I think a lot of people in college and otherwise are a bit fearful of genetics and totally. Especially if they think there's math involved, it's very complicated. And you managed to bring some fun to your genetics. And I know this because you've been generous in helping me when I had to teach genetics for the first time, think about how to do it in an engaging way. And
I learned a lot from my professor. I learned a lot from his style.
I was going to say, like, did you integrate that from the way that he captured your attention? And has that always informed your teaching regardless of the topic that you've taught?
I mean, I would say there's obviously more than one influence for sure, but I mean, certainly he's one of the most positive influences on it. And I love that sort of narrative style and, you know, weaving a story around it. We can come back to that. We talk about like integration to public speaking as well too, but I like this narrative style and having a story and not just a fact, you know, throwing these things out. I will say there are also some negative influences that I won't cite, but there are some things where I see somebody doing something like, oh yeah, I really don't like that. And actually a lot of people do that. I want to make sure I'm not doing that going forward. Which is, it's interesting that with our careers, and yeah, I'm sure you've experienced this as well, it's odd that we've received very little explicit training in most of our job. It's much more than just this, like, muddle through, see what works well, and then copy those pieces you liked and don't copy the pieces you didn't like. It, aside from the research part, we actually receive a lot of training on, but the teaching, the management of personnel, all these kinds of things, we you know, the financial pieces, there's like nothing, and we just figure it out as we go along, which is,
well, right. Yeah, you get your diploma and then it's like hope for the best, all the best. Right? Yeah. And I do feel like it would be, given, you know, how many people manage other people, the teaching that's involved, the mentoring that's involved, mm-hmm. like you said, the financial, like handling budgets, we should probably be taking some courses on that as we go.
Basically, small businesses, right? And
yes, I was just thinking
nothing that. Along those lines.
Yeah. Well, and you know, to add to your sort of credentials, you've also published some popular science books, and I love Live Long and Evolve, What Star Trek Can Teach Us About Evolution, Genetics, and Life on Other Worlds. And, you know, there's so much to unpack there. And I always thought that, like, Pokemon would be a great game to teach about adaptation to different environments. And you've made this great connection between Star Trek and evolution. How did that come about? And
sure. So I have to cite also one positive role model in that regard, and that is a colleague of my professor, Eric Spana, who's over at also in the biology department at Duke. So in 2014, my daughter asked me to go with her to Dragon Con, which is this big sci-fi comic convention in Atlanta, Georgia. And it's around Labor Day weekend. You know, it spans that there. And Professor Eric Spana is somebody who actually regularly goes to that. And he was already going to that convention, and he would give talks on genetics, but base it on, for example, like the inheritance of wizarding in Harry Potter. He doesn't do that anymore now, since Harry Potter's kind of fallen out of favor for obvious reasons.
Right.
But he did a couple of other things like that too, like, you know, the genetics, or the, basically what you see in terms of the species in the video game Mass Effect. So I went to this convention. I saw a couple of his talks. I saw some other things there, and I thought, wow, this is great. I would love to do this. So I broached actor Garrett Wong, who's actually the person who runs the Trek track at Dragon Con in 2015. So I went in 2014. I broached him in 2015 and said, well, look, I could imagine a case of making some sort of talk about all these different species we see in Star Trek and trying to connect it to teaching evolution. Because, you know, evolution, as you know, is something that people sometimes cringe to talk about because people have an immediate reaction to it. But maybe that's a softer entry. We're like, oh, we're going to talk about it in this context. And then, oops, surprise, we actually taught you something about real biology. And he was all in. He said, absolutely. So 2016, I did that for the first time. As I was preparing that talk, I was approached by Princeton University Press asking, would you be interested in writing a popular science book and also giving a talk associated with it? And what I told them is that the talk I give the most often is this sort of why evolution is true talk. There's a book with exactly that title written by my former PhD advisor, Jerry Coyne. There's no way I could improve upon that. It's an excellent book. So they said, well, are there any other public talks you're doing like around now? I said, well, actually, there's this one I'm working on. Now that you mention it. So I had made a draft version of that talk for DragonCon. I put on YouTube and I shared that with the publisher. And she watched it and she said, wow, this is really interesting. You could make that into a full book. I said, yeah, I could totally make that. I mean, it wouldn't be just on that topic, but it'd be more broadly using Star Trek. The great thing about Star Trek is, you know, number one, there's a lot of it. So if you're looking for any particular kind of content, you can find it. At the time, there were over 700 episodes. Now there's well over 800 episodes of Star Trek out there. So mm-hmm. you can find just about anything. And two, they tend to try to explain stuff with real-world science. It's very rare that they have just magic. It's not like the Force with Star Wars or anything like that. They tend to try to explain things. And they have often recruited people to be science consultants historically. So in the 1990s Star Trek, it was Andre Bormanis, who has training as a physicist, and he was the one who was advising them on those pieces. So yeah, that was how that came about. And it's been really fun because the reception to the book has been very positive, as well as the reception to those sorts of talks. Since that time, I've given those talks at various other conventions and on and other venues and things like that. And people seem really excited about it. Because, I mean, not surprisingly, the people who like Star Trek also kind of like science too.
Well, and I loved Star Trek. Like when I was growing up, William Shatner was like, you know, he was everything. And And, you know, and I like what you're saying about it. It's a good entry point because no one is going to say, oh, I can't believe he's saying we come from Klingons. You don't sort of internalize it in the same way that sometimes when you're just presenting, you know, or wanting to talk about evolution and the evolutionary process, you bump up against some of those beliefs or misconceptions that prevent someone from seeing. And so I use analogies with animal behavior, other animal behavior, I should specify, because we are animals.
Of course.
But I'm never suggesting that we are dragonflies. Mm-hmm. Right? If we can relate to the dragonfly, we see ourselves reflected in some behavioral interaction, and we can go, oh, wow, my Uncle Bob, he kind of acts like that. That's very interesting. And so I kind of zoomorphize people rather than anthropomorphize animals. And and so I think, you know, this connection to Star Trek is genius. And now, is it okay if I let the Klingon out of the bag and say that you are also now yourself a consultant for the show?
Yeah, very honored to be that. Yes, that's been wonderful. Actually, I want to come back to something you said earlier, though, too, in terms of Star Trek, this sort of using these analogies with other species. That is what Star Trek has been doing since the 1960s in the context of social concepts, less so on the science, but very heavily on the social. It's just look, it's not racism the way we think about it here. It's just like it. And it's just about these other types on this other planet. So Star Trek has been doing that forever. I mean, people often say, like, why has Star Trek become so liberal? Like, Star Trek was always very wrong.
Right.
Very much so.
Yes. Yeah, our response to it just wasn't as, you know, affronted, I suppose.
Exactly. A little bit more allegorical, but sometimes not. Sometimes it's very in your face, even in the 60s version. But yeah, I'm very honored now that, like, for a couple of the current series, Star Trek Discovery, actually, I did the most with for seasons 3 and season 4, especially. Yeah, it was great. And actually, what's really funny is at DragonCon, that first DragonCon I went to, I met somebody else whose name is Dr. Erin McDonald. She has a PhD in astrophysics from Glasgow. And she also gives these sorts of talks, but more on the physics and these things. And we actually started pairing up and would sometimes do talks together at various conventions. What's funny is that she and I were brought independently, but at the same time into work on Star Trek. So I remember one point in time, I said, well, we're going to pair you up for this first project with this astrophysicist we know. Her name is Dr. Erin McDonald. Like, I know her very well. So it was great getting paired up with her. Now, she, in her case, she actually went all in. So I'm just somebody who gets occasionally contracted. She is actually now the staff member on retainer for all the current Star Trek series to discuss science in them.
Wow.
I like to say she's the sheriff of science in Star Trek, and I'm just somebody who's an occasional deputy.
Well, that's okay, you know, because deputies are also important, as you know. And so, but what I'd love for people to hear a little bit about, to the extent that you're able to share, is what is it like for someone like you? I mean, you're at Duke University, you are an evolutionary biologist, your research is, you know, very, I wanted to use the word hardcore, you know, genetics, but eloquently answering really deep questions about natural selection, evolution, all of these types of processes. What is it like for you? What is that experience like to consult on a show?
It's amazing. Well, I mean, of course, since I'm a Star Trek fan, like there's no way it would be anything but amazing. But actually, all the Star Trek activities do connect to the university in various sorts of ways. Let me come back to the consulting thing, but let me tell you about some other connections. For the book that you mentioned, Live Long and Evolve, I actually have used as a textbook for non-majors intro course, which literally comes on their transcript as Genetics, Evolution, Star Trek. But if you look at the coverage, it's exactly the same as the intro genetics and evolution class that majors have, just at a slightly lighter level and with more narrative. And we use the narratives. We'll literally like watch all or part of an episode and we'll talk about like, well, okay, you saw this depiction. What do you think that means? How does that work? And I think it really helps. And at least the student reports seem to suggest that this actually helps them retain it because there's a story to it. Like, oh yes, I remember this concept because it was in the context of like when Trip Tucker from Enterprise did blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
And even if they haven't seen Star Trek before, just having a narrative that they can associate with it is really helpful. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of the outreach parts, the National Science Foundation, as you know, funds grants both for scientific merit, but also what they refer to as broader impacts. And the broader impacts part they want is some serious science communication. So actually, the broader impacts I proposed in my most recent grant, which is funded, is actually giving these sorts of talks at conventions and things like that. So it actually is part of my job to do this sort of thing. And yeah. What's great now, connecting back to your actual question, which is about the consulting, it's kind of, it brings things basically full circle. Because in terms of the convention talks, I'm using the science that's actually in episodes to try to explain to the public. And then with the consulting, you're actually inserting the science into the episode and making sure it's as good as possible. And it's wonderful. And what's great is that the people who are associated with Star Trek, the writers and producers, things like that, they are really excited about science. They're often telling me things like, oh my gosh, your job is so cool. Like, are you serious? You literally write Star Trek. You're telling me my job is cool?
I've been told I was the most interesting person in the room. And I'm like, I beg to differ, you know? but yeah, because I have consulted on a few documentaries, one TV show. And in all of my cases, there's been a desire to integrate accurate scientific information in an engaging and entertaining way, which, you know, I don't know about for you, but for me was a relief because I care so much and I fundamentally believe that science is fun and engaging and entertaining when it's packaged, you know. It's not your vegetables dipped in chocolate. It's actually in and of itself something delightful to behold. And so it wasn't always, though, something that was valued by scientists to do. And I don't know if you could talk a little bit about when you started, was sort of around the same time that I had the chance to be on a radio show with comedian D.L. Hughley. And we did 4 years of, I had a segment called Think Like a Human, Act Like an Animal.
Wow.
And it was a great fun, but I hadn't yet found a position. I was a postdoc at Duke's National Evolutionary Synthesis Center. And I had an encounter where somebody, a coral reef biologist, don't remember his name, said, "Congratulations on your career change."
Wow.
And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, now instead of doing science, you just talk about it."
Oh my gosh.
I know. And so,
that's,
you know,
so condescending.
I felt that way too. But I also, you know, thought, well, you know, I feel like it's important, but it wasn't always considered a valuable part of our time. So how have you seen that change since you started embarking on that journey?
Well, I did have the privilege that I already was a tenured professor at the point in time I was doing these things. So to some extent, you know, I got a couple of funny looks from people. I got a couple of wayward comments that I won't share that were less than completely positive, but sometimes I was like, I have tenure, whatever. You can have that opinion, but I totally disagree. I do think that the majority of people with whom I interact are actually quite positive about it. I mean, I think a lot of people really understand. I mean, especially as from the past decade, we've seen a lot of skepticism towards good science, and we've seen a lot of consequences from that skepticism toward good science. So this ability to reach out is vitally important. And coming back to the point you said about, like, you know, doing versus talking about or something like that. I mean, let me go back to the undergrad advisor I brought up in the very beginning. I mean, I would never have gone to science if it weren't for him. I would never have gone to this field if it weren't for him. I probably would have gone to science, but probably definitely not this field. He not only inspired me, but like he was actually the undergrad advisor for my graduate advisor, for also that person's previous advisor. Various faculty at Duke, like Greg Ray, who you might remember from Duke, he also worked in this person's lab. There's like an incredible number of evolutionary biologists who are very well established, who all went through this person's class. And every one of them, without exception, credits him as why they went into it. That is the pipeline. Like you can say, like, oh, I'm doing great science, but then you're doing great science and then you retire. That's it. You're done. Whereas he's the pipeline and people like him are the pipeline. And not just in the context of undergraduate teaching, but also people who are communicators and grabbing people who are, you know, from the outside. The other thing too, is we need the public to be excited about these things too. Right. Because again, there's so much skepticism of science and we can do whatever we're going to do. But if it sticks just in our community and that's as far as it gets, then we've basically failed. We need to be able to penetrate the broader public with these messages about what good science is, what is natural selection, what is evolution, how does this apply to our everyday lives?
Yeah. Well, and before we sort of maybe talk a little bit about what some of those biggest misconceptions are that you've bumped up against that people have, you know, I want to sort of ask now, you know, how important do you think it is for scientists to be in charge of the conversation around science?
Oh, I think it's vital. Yeah, I think that. Now, I would say being in charge is always a little bit of a tricky verb.
Okay.
So we have to be a vital part to it. Now, I don't, you know, I wouldn't say that every scientist has to take a top role in it. You know, that's fair. Because, I mean, different people have different priorities and abilities and things like that. So fair enough about that. But I think it's vital that we're a big part of the game. And we're not just saying, oh, communicators will deal with that. Like, no.
Yes. That's sort of what I meant by taking charge is not that we are the only ones that talk about science, but that we are an active participant.
100%.
And sometimes, you know, valuing, I think there should be a greater value for those of us that enjoy it, are good at it, and can communicate our fellow colleagues' work in a meaningful way. Maybe sometimes more, I don't want to use the word accurately, but more fully, than say when you're talking to a journalist and you have to sort of cover all this background, of certain terms, it can really limit what you can talk about.
Totally. And I really admire journalists for their ability to get it as close. And people, you know, I know scientists sometimes are critical of journalists, but I think that's not really fair. I mean, if I was to try to talk about the breadth of disciplines that they're talking about, there is no way I could do as good a job as them. So, like, you know, and I've seen some scientists who actually speak to journalists and they don't in any way try to simplify. Like, okay, well, if you can't simplify it for this person who's very eager to make this easily accessible, then nobody's going to understand you outside of your little subcommunity. Maybe you can be a little hero in your subcommunity for not quote unquote dumbing it down, but you've lost. You basically lost the broader reach you could have had.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes, and what's great, I think about those of us who want to speak to outside of our community is there has to be a little bit of, not a little bit, maybe a lot of it, of filtering some of the details and not getting stuck in making sure every single point. I always call it like, I remain accurate without, you know, having to list every single detail about the process. Yeah. And how have you navigated that when it comes to evolution and genetics, which is arguably a really big and complicated topic?
It is a big one. I mean, you mentioned this earlier, the power of analogy is always very strong. Like, you know, if you can give a good analogy, even if it's not a perfect analogy, but at least gets the general concept across, that's very powerful. Actually, what's happened a lot recently, I'll say COVID has made things a lot easier in terms of like explaining how natural selection works. Because when we talk about the spread of these different variants, that's natural selection. That's very, very simple. And people would say, oh, isn't that just a theory? Like, oh, are you telling me the spread of Omicron was just a theory? I mean, like you saw it. It's just math. It's literally just math. And like if you have heredity, if you have variation, if you have differential survival reproduction, which we had those between, say, Delta and Omicron or any of the more recent ones, then you get this thing and you can use those as examples now. And everybody knows because they've seen that happen and they've seen it in not even just in their lifetimes, but just in the last couple of years. And they've seen the plots of it and things like that. Like, there you go. That's a plot of like, what would happen if you have a selective advantage of X, you know?
Yeah.
You've seen these things. So that's been extremely helpful lately.
Well, and, you know, I've always wondered why, you know, a lot of people are also familiar with antibiotic resistance, and yet it doesn't seem to have translated as easily. And so what do you think has been the biggest misconceptions you've come up against when you're communicating, about these topics? And why do some, you know, why do you think some examples work better than others?
Yeah. So antibiotic resistance, I think what ends up happening is often people think it's a property of us as opposed to a property of the bacteria. And that's where it's like, no, it has like nothing to do with us.
Okay. Wow.
That's where I think things go awry. Whereas I think for like the variants of COVID, they very much, like, they don't think that's us. It's very clear that's a COVID thing. Like that virus is spread. So that has helped quite a bit. I mean, the most common thing I get, of course, and I'm sure you get this as well, too, is this whole, oh, isn't that just a theory? Like, oh, my gosh.
Or, you know, well, I'm not descendant from a chimp, or a monkey.
That's a big one too, this misconception between like our evolutionary cousins versus who we actually descend from. And that's something actually a lot of sci-fi also tends to get wrong. But actually, even in cases where sci-fi gets it wrong, it's instructive because A, then we know this is a public misconception. And B, we can use that misconception as a teaching tool, saying like, hey, this is what you tend to see in X or Y TV show. However, that's wrong and here's why. So, I mean, it's not like things in sci-fi have to be right in order to be instructive.
Correct. That's an excellent point. And, you know, how do you navigate overcoming some of those misconceptions? How do you use them as a teaching tool for folks?
You nailed it. The point is to use them, not to try to overcome them, right? So I literally just flag it. And that's what I try to do in the book that you mentioned, Live Long and Evolve. I try to flag some misconceptions that show up. So the one of the most common ones is the one you just mentioned, the sense of, you know, confusing evolutionary cousins from who we descend from. So people will say, like, you know, I didn't descend from a chimpanzee. Like, you're right. You didn't descend from a chimpanzee, but you and a chimpanzee descended from something else that was neither human nor a chimpanzee. And like I like to use that analogy, and I like to basically use a phylogenetic tree, which is like a tree of animal relationships over, you know, many, many, many millions of years. I like to compare that to like a family tree. So like, yes, I'm not a descendant of my cousin, but my cousin and I have a common ancestor, and our common ancestor is our grandparents. Yes, I'm not a descendant of my second cousin, but we have a common ancestor. Those are our great grandparents. And like using that analogy is like, oh yeah, okay, I see what you mean. So like we, like present day is this generation.
Yes.
And it's the same thing, but just on much longer time scales. And it's not, again, it's not a perfect analogy, but it's pretty darn close.
Well, now I feel very proud of myself because, you know, I, other than that one semester where I taught genetics, and again, thanks to your help, because it was like I had 2 weeks, you know, to figure out how to teach genetics for the first time.
March 2020.
And I've always used that analogy as well, a family tree and a phylogenetic tree. It's not a perfect one-to-one, but it people always know about family trees. And now with Ancestry.com and 23andMe, you know, and they're like, oh, we found a distant cousin we never knew existed, you know, and
but you didn't descend from them.
Right. And that can also help. Yeah. We discovered a new fossil that shakes up the human family tree, you know, what has excited you the most about being able to interact with the public in these kinds of ways?
Oh, I love interactions that connect with something about their own history. So I recently was just speaking on the Star Trek cruise back in February of this year, back in February 2023. And somebody came to me with their Ancestry.com data, and they were trying to figure out who their father was. But I mean, they didn't have, obviously, that data from the original men, it would have been very easy. But what they had instead was relatives of the potential people. And the two potential people that she was trying to narrow it down to were siblings, which made it a lot more challenging. But nonetheless, based on who their descendants were and things like that, we were actually able to narrow it down with almost complete confidence which person it was. And that was fascinating because it was an interesting problem. Like, okay, we have this. Well, what would this person have? So, and we were able to map it out saying, well, okay, well, he only has one X chromosome. So the other daughter who we know is his daughter would have had to have gotten that one. And you would have had to have gotten the same thing there. So by virtue of the fact your X and her X are identical, you know, or one copy of them, then that means, so we were able to narrow it down using these sorts of little tricks in genetics that come out. So that was fascinating. And I love interactions like that where you can actually apply it to people's actual lives. It's a lot tougher when people start bringing up, you know, horrible medical things like, oh, I might have blah, blah, blah. Like, ooh, you really should go see a genetic counselor. I don't know if I want to tell you have some terrible disease. That's probably better for.
Well, you know, I'm probably going to be calling you when I sequence my entire genome. You can do that now and you get this whole printout and you can actually dig in there and look for certain, you know, alleles and things. But I'm curious, when you've had these kinds of interactions, how has that fed back to influence your teaching?
Examples. I mean, I would never use, of course, somebody's actual data. That would be terrible. But sure. Getting examples from these sorts of things, like, oh, well, this was the trick where I was able to use this. So I can just make up some fake data that uses that same sort of trick and then have a problem like that I can use that's instructive for students.
Okay. Now, you brought up earlier about lethal alleles and how we were going to circle back to that and why they're still present. And now, Okay, I'll be the student here for a second and see if my understanding has always been, you know, lethal alleles can stay in a population depending on when they start influencing an individual's survivorship. So if it's post-reproductive, then natural selection isn't really going to flush it out of the system, so to speak. And that is sometimes how we explain the presence of lethal alleles.
That's absolutely true. That's more in the context of senescence. I mean, that's one of the theories for senescence or aging, basically. Like, okay. It's called the mutation accumulation theory, that basically if there are things that accumulate that affect your lifetime, but post-reproductively, then you wouldn't. So what the lethal alleles I'm working on are ones that would be like, basically you wouldn't even get to reproductive age.
Oh, okay.
So that wouldn't especially apply. But your point is that you're absolutely right. Nonetheless, just it's not the subset of lethal alleles that we're focusing on. So for us, I mean, there's sort of two broad categories we're looking at. So, or two broad explanations. And one is just that there are enough genes out there that can mutate to become lethal. And the mutation rate is just high enough that, yes, as natural selection is feeding some out, but, you know, new ones are being introduced in. You basically have this sort of like, you know, this inflow and outflow of these things over time. And it's not necessarily all the same genes. It's a whole bunch of different genes, but like, okay, this one's basically weeded out, but this other one has popped up someplace else. There's evidence that that's probably true for some of it. The other, which is more interesting, is whether some might be actively mutated. The ones that we're focusing on, of course, are all recessed. I mean, you have to have two copies of the lethal allele. Otherwise, if there was one copy was lethal, then it would go away immediately by any cause.
Sure. Right. Because if you have two copies of the same thing that'll kill you, it'll just kill you.
That'll just kill you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So for the ones that are recessive, the other possibility is that maybe there's some sort of other kind of selection actively maintaining. So the example people always like to cite is, of course, sickle cell anemia. That if you have two of the bad copies, and you have sickle cell anemia, which is a terrible disease. I mean, it's not exactly lethal immediately, but it's a terrible disease. If you have one copy, you don't have the disease, but you have an advantage that you actually are resistant to malaria. So in countries where malaria is very common, you tend to see a fairly high incidence of sickle cell. So this is the explanation for that. Now, I'm studying this in a natural population of fruit flies. I literally caught like hundreds of flies from my backyard. We've identified that something like half of them had some sort of lethal causing variant in there, which is pretty high. And this is just on one chromosome, no less. So we're trying to figure out like basically what are these things? And this is interesting because this is a topic that was studied heavily in the 1960s and 1970s, but they didn't have the tools that we have today. And it was coming from a conversation I had with a grad student of mine. So I was telling her about these classic works from the 60s and 70s. She said, what was the resolution? I said, well, honestly, I don't know that they fully resolved it. People kind of basically decided at the end it was this influx by mutation, outflow by selection. But they never really proved it. They never really proved that that was all of it. Maybe that explains like 80% of it, but 20% is the other stuff. But in thinking about it, I was like, well, you know, genetic tools are a lot better right now. The statistical tools are also a lot better now. We could actually like nail this question. So we have gone through, we've isolated a bunch of these chromosomes. We've actually mapped what the actual genes are for several of them. We're doing a bunch of simulations to try to predict like under these different scenarios, which would persist. So it's very much in progress. I don't actually have just an answer for you. I can't just say it's blah.
Right.
But we know what some of the genes are, which is a huge advantage over before. And there's some that actually have persisted for many years. Like there's some that like different flies have at least a mutation, the same gene. We don't know if it's the same mutation yet or not, but at least a mutation, the same gene that span like 2018 and 2020 and 2021. Like, okay, that's a lot of fly generations.
Well, right. Cause what is the generation time of a fly?
So in the lab, it's about 2 weeks. In the wild, I'm guessing it's a lot slower, but it's definitely gonna be multiple generations a year nonetheless.
Sure. Right. And now, so as you were talking, you know, I, of course, have my own background, which I'm listening and I think, oh, yeah, I remember learning all of that. And no, I don't remember it ever getting resolved. And this is really interesting. And I think one of the, you know, points that a lot of people raise is, well, why are we funding all this, you know, hokey pokey fruit fly science? What on earth? I think I remember seeing a comment about grizzly bear. Why did we spend $400,000 to understand what's going on in a grizzly bear? But, you know, we should be able to answer that question.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to this kind of work and genetics on fruit flies, how is that important to us and our day-to-day lives?
Totally. So it's very important because honestly, this is probably one of the biggest causes of inbreeding depression that's out there. Like if people breed with close relatives, there's all sorts of, you know, problems that tend to come out from this. Not that I'm saying like we're trying to make it so it's okay to breed with your relatives. I'm not pushing that, but I'm just saying like a specific application. And that
we're going to solve the problem of the royals.
Yeah, huh? Yeah, I know. But I mean, that's one of the cases where it's come out a lot is in the royals. It's also, I've actually done talks outside of Star Trek. We're talking about Star Trek earlier. I've done talks on inbreeding in Game of Thrones to connect to this sort of thing. There's lots of inbreeding in Game of Thrones. There's also lots of people who like are crazy or have a lot of stillborn kids. This is the reason for it. And you know, so understanding the process here, we'll try to understand why this came about. Like, why did we end up having these things happen? But sometimes it's even much more proximate things. One of the first mutations we found was in a particular gene. Turns out that particular gene that we found it in is something that's shared with humans and is also associated with the most common childhood kidney cancer that's out there. So
wow,
just happened to be the case. So like, okay, so there's potentially like much closer applications than the sort of general understanding why inbreeding is bad and why you have problems associated with breeding with close relatives.
Well, and I think that people, one, might be surprised that we share any genes at all with a fruit fly. Yeah. We look so different. Recently in Florida, there were now 7 cases of malaria. 6 are homegrown and one was the result of travel. And so, you know, and sickle cell anemia is not as prevalent in the United States as it is in some Mediterranean and African, both Northern African and Sub-Saharan African. You know, I just came back from Uganda and the irony is I'm in Florida and I managed to not get malaria in Uganda and I'm home a week and I see the news and I'm like, oh, wouldn't that be ironic that I
was afraid you were going to say you got it here. I'm like, oh my goodness.
No, I'm so sorry. No, but you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. And so when we think about changing, I know I'm going completely off topic here, but when we think about changing climates, changing environments for ourselves and other species, how much of a role does understanding the genetic landscape we're moving around in play in what life can look like in the future?
Oh, like it's 100%. I mean, again, natural selection acts on gene variants. I mean, understanding the genetics is fundamental to understanding how natural selection is going to work. It's absolutely vital. Yeah, like there's no workaround for it. I mean, like, so coming back to, I was using COVID examples earlier, you know, I mean, we're saying this thing is Omicron or Delta, but those are gene variants. I mean, it's just based on a specific DNA or RNA sequence. You know, that's where that's coming from.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people have spent a lot of time discussing, you know, nature versus nurture. And the nature is always the genetic component and the nurture is always the other stuff. Yeah. And so I'm not asking you for a definitive answer. I would ask you, you know, how can we think about this differently than a this or a that when it comes to better understanding not just the process of science and what it means for other animals and ourselves, but just about life on this planet in general?
Yeah. So actually one of the most common misconceptions is that whole nature versus nurture. And people ask me that often, well, which one's more important? Like, it's always both. there's very, 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 very few things here that are solidly one versus the other. It might be like what language you speak would be, okay, that's solidly nurture. Maybe your hair color, if you don't dye your hair, would be solidly nature. But like, aside from like trivial things like that, any sort of like anything, if you're looking about any sort of disease, any sort of complex trait, it's always both. And there's often, it's not even just the two of them, but it's also various forms of interaction between them. You know, so certain people may have a genotype which predisposes them to be more susceptible to getting lung cancer from being exposed to smoke, you know, just as an example. Like, and so it's always these sorts of things, you know, both kinds and the interaction thereof that are associated with it. The more we figure it out, the more we can figure out like what are the best strategies for mitigating these things. But I will say it's going to be an uphill battle. There's a lot, and it's unfortunately nature is not static. So we can study for 30 years, but nature won't be exactly the same 30 years from now.
Right.
Today, because again, there's ecology and evolution happening around that. So
Well, I know you're very busy and you have a very big job at the university. And so I don't want to take up your entire afternoon. But, you know, when you wrote Live Long and Evolve, What Star Trek Can Teach Us About Evolution, Genetics, and Life on Other Worlds, which I think everyone should get a copy of.
Thank you.
What about life on other worlds? Because recently there was phosphorus, I think it was phosphorus on one of Saturn's moons. And so as someone who has consulted for the show, and it's all based on life on these other planets, and, you know, what do you think about the possibility that there is some form of life on another planet?
Oh, I'm certain there is. I'm certain there's something out there that is a life form on another planet. Now, the question is going to be like, is it going to be like in Star Trek with First Contact, where this spaceship lands and people come out and they look basically like us, except having pointy ears? That's incredibly unlikely for a million reasons. But I think the most likely life we're going to find, if you think about the first several billion years of life on Earth, most of it was, you know, microscopic unicellular or something like that. That's probably the most likely thing we would find by going over to, say, Enceladus or, you know, any of Jupiter or Saturn's moons, things like that. That's what we're most likely to find. I don't know that we'll find it there, but, you know, the first life we'll find is more likely that kind of thing if we come upon it.
Are you hopeful that something like that is discovered in your lifetime?
Oh, I would love that. Oh my gosh, it would be so cool. Because I mean, everything we do right now has this, as we call it, the end of one problem, that there's one origin of life. Every life form that we know is descended from that one origin of life. Getting around that problem would dramatically improve our understanding of everything related to biology and evolution, things like that. And I always say that even the way we define life might change at that point. Because right now, our definition is based on having seen one thing. But imagine, for example, that you'd only ever seen one game. Let's say you'd only ever seen Settlers of Catan. You define games based on that. And maybe there are some derivatives thereof, like other seafarers, there's Cities and Knights of Catan, all these other things. Okay, I mean, it's basically all the life you see on Earth. If you go someplace else and somebody's playing a hacky sack, like everything you thought about, like, okay, none of this stuff applies here.
Right. It's basically a complete identity crisis.
Right?
Yeah.
And that could happen. I mean, we may see something that looks basically like Settlers of Catan. We may see something that looks like a hacky sack.
Well, I want to thank you for all the work that you're doing to bring science to others in a variety
of formats. Thank you for the same.
And I will make sure I put links on the show notes for your books and how they could follow you. And then, of course, bombard you with the evolution questions based on Game of Thrones, Star Trek, and any other show that is out there talking about these kinds of things. Thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
In case you couldn't tell, I was a huge Star Trek fan growing up, and I may have had a tiny crush on Captain Kirk. After listening to this episode, when you think about it, science has such a profound impact on our daily lives and our collective imagination. Science isn't just about equations and experiments. It's about curiosity, discovery, and creativity. And perhaps most importantly, it's about the people behind the science. We are driven by an insatiable desire to understand the world around us. And I'm using the word scientist broadly here because science is a way of knowing. Now, before I forget, check out the show notes for links to Dr. Noor's lab, books, and social media handles. Today, we've explored how evolutionary biology intersects with the infinite possibilities of Star Trek, reminding us that science is involved in so many things. From the smallest microbe to the farthest galaxies, science illuminates the beauty and complexity of the universe and invites us to marvel at it all. Keep that curiosity and creativity alive in your own life, whether you're gazing up at the stars or watching the birds get after those seeds in your backyard. Remember, science is all around us, shaping our understanding of the world and enriching our lives in so many different ways. Next time, we're going to continue the conversation about science communication. Until then, keep your eyes and hearts open, live long and prosper. This is Wild Connection, signing off.